Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the May 28th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Well, last Thursday, the House of Representatives overwhelmingly approved more than $600 billion of what is misleadingly called defense spending while rejecting the Pentagon's efforts to retire the Warthog A-10 air support fighter. As, quote, unquote, Defense News described it, the Chamber's version of the 2015 National Defense Authorization Act includes a $495.8 billion base Pentagon budget and $79.4 billion more for an overseas contingency operations, overseas OCO, they call it, budget. The vote was 325-98 for the legislation, with 216 Republicans and 109 Democrats backing the bill, and over 80 Democrats and more than 10 Republicans voting no. The budget legislation crafted by the House Armed Services Committee, no doubt with the assistance of lobbyists from the military-industrial complex, also authorizes $17.9 billion in Energy Department programs, which may include $7.9 billion to upgrade the country's stock of nuclear missile warheads. And the amount could still grow larger, according to Defense News, because the Overseas Contingency Operations, or OCO, amount is open-ended in that the White House could send over an exact amount for the war in Afghanistan after the bill later goes to conference to resolve any differences between the House and Senate versions. The Times of Israel reported that lawmakers also doubled the funding for the Israeli Iron Dome anti-missile system, calling for an extra $175 million in funding for the system on top of the $176 million it currently gets annually from the Pentagon, which is considered part of the U.S. military budget and is not charged against Israel as foreign aid. In advance of the White House vote, Defense News reported that the 2015 National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, too closely resembles what emerged from the House Armed Services Committee and subsequently approved by the entire House. His aides would recommend a presidential veto. The White House Office of Management and Budget, OMB, charged on May 19th, Statement of Administration Policy, that the HASC passed bill, quote, does not include meaningful compensation reforms and other cost-saving measures, rejects many of the department's proposed force structure changes, and restricts the Department of Defense's ability to manage its weapons systems and infrastructure, end quote. To analyze the current military budget proposals and their significance, I'll be speaking at 20 minutes past the hour with William Hartung, Director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy and author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. That's prophets as in the biblical sense, as well literally in the financial sense. His recent pieces on the military budget include Get Rid of the Pentagon Slush Fund and House Bill is Good News for Pentagon Contractors. In the interim, let's look at some recent developments on the international scene that you haven't heard about in a week that has had no shortage of coups, staged elections, and elections that have shaken the gray heads that run the European Union, plus a visit to Israel and the occupied Palestine, or territories by the new and popular Pope Francis, that also was not without controversy. First, you've heard that the U.S. will leave 9,800 troops in Afghanistan after the final withdrawal of U.S. combat forces in December, and with plans to gradually reduce that number to zero by the end of 2016, as President Obama announced Tuesday and then repeated this morning. The residual force will include both troops to train and advise the country's military and a separate group of special operations forces to continue counterterrorism missions against what Obama called, quote, the remnants of al-Qaeda, end quote. The troops will include forces to train and advise Afghanistan's military and group of special operation forces. The decision, however, is contingent upon Afghanistan's new president signing a bilateral security agreement that current President Hamid Karzai has refused to sign. The two candidates in a runoff election scheduled for June 14th, Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani, have both said they will sign the accord. They love having American troops there. The bottom line, said President Obama, is it's time to turn the page on more than a decade in which so much of our foreign policy was focused on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. We have to recognize Afghanistan will not be a perfect place, and it is not America's responsibility to make it one, Obama added. The future of Afghanistan must be decided by Afghans. end quote. What neither Obama nor the media mentioned is what has held up the signing of the document allowing U.S. troops to stay in Afghanistan to this point. It's that President Karzai, following in the footsteps of Iraqi President Maliki, would not agree that American soldiers would be immune from prosecution by the Afghan government or its courts for crimes they might commit against Afghan civilians. That part of Afghanistan's future will not, it seems, be decided by Afghans. But they will not be alone. U.S. forces are immune from prosecution in all the 130-plus countries where they are stationed. This morning, President Obama made that major foreign policy address at West Point, outlining his policy in Afghanistan and his decision to spend $5 billion, $5 billion, on funding counterterrorism operations in Africa, where terrorist groups have, thanks to the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, made their appearance, and which ironically or intentionally have been additionally aided by NATO's overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya, which led to the looting of the country's weapons storerooms and the spread of the contents throughout the continent, including some into the hands, reportedly, of Boko Haram in Nigeria. Well, now for something you haven't heard about, the latest evidence that the Project for a New American Century is alive and well, operating under another name, of course, but pushing the same agenda, U.S. dominance in the world with Israel as its main ally. PNAC was founded by Robert Kagan and the odious Bill Kristol in 1997 with a mission to make America the unchallenged dominator of the planet against which no other country or combination of countries would even consider competing. What was needed to get the American public energized behind the endless wars and military spending that would be required for the success of this project, read PNAC's founding statement, was a Pearl Harbor-type event, and they got that on 9/11. By coincidence, the PNAC signatories believed the most immediate threat to their plan of world domination was Saddam Hussein, whose regime in Iraq at that time was mired in sanctions. A strange choice, one might say, but no matter, getting rid of him would not only be good for the U.S., it would be good for Israel. After Saddam had fallen, PNAC folded his tent with as little fanfare as when it had appeared. Indeed, even Noam Chomsky never mentioned it. In 2009, it reappeared, thanks to the sponsorship of the very same Kagan and Kristol, as a foreign policy initiative, which was dubbed PNAC II. I've talked about that before. It joined another stealth pro-Israel operation, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which I've also mentioned before. 5 days a week, the FPI provides a selection of the top foreign policy articles of the day to members of Congress and to the media and subscribers. It hosts events that it uses to shape foreign policy along neoconservative lines. Many of the key articles it sends out are written by FPI board members under different hats, and all of them, to be sure, wear a wide variety of them. Kagan served as John McCain's foreign policy advisor in 2008 election, and he currently sits on Hillary Clinton's foreign policy advisory board. Should Clinton become the first woman in the White House, it is quite likely Kagan would be given a prominent role either as Secretary of State or as National Security Advisor. His wife, Victoria Nuland Kagan, as you may have heard me tell it, was Hillary's spokeswoman while she was Secretary of State, and afterward President Obama appointed her to be Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasia, where one of her jobs apparently was to play a leading role in overthrowing the elected government of Viktor Yanukovych in Ukraine, which I have documented in previous programs. Now, hubby Robert is very concerned about the apparent unwillingness of the American people to play the leading role in the world that he and his fellow neocons believe this country is obliged to play, that they may be tired of sacrificing their family members and their standard of living for foreign wars that America didn't win, Kagan is not ready to accept. In the current issue of the neoliberal New Republic, he has penned a 12,000-plus word essay titled, quote, "Superpowers Don't Get to Retire, What Our Tired Country Still Owes the World," end quote, which may become to be seen as a neocon's opening salvo to restore the Cold War mentality that dominated American politics for the 45 years following World War II. It's worth quoting at some length. Kagan explains early on that, quote, Many Americans and their political leaders in both parties, including President Obama, have either forgotten or rejected the assumptions that undergirded American foreign policy for the past seven decades. In particular, he writes, American foreign policy may be moving away from the sense of global responsibility that equated American interests with the interests of many others around the world and back toward the defense of narrower, more parochial national interest. This is sometimes called isolationism, says Kagan, but that's not the right word. It may be more correct to describe as a search for normalcy. At the core of American unease, he says, is a desire to shed the unusual burdens of responsibility that previous generations of Americans took on in World War II and throughout the Cold War, and to return to being a more normal kind of nation, more attuned to its own needs and less to those of the wider world. If this is indeed what a majority of Americans seek today, Kagan warns, then the current period of retrenchment will not be a temporary pause before an inevitable return to global activism. It will mark a new phase in the evolution of America's foreign policy. And because America's role in shaping the world order has been so unusually powerful and pervasive, it will also begin a new phase of the international system, one that promises not to be marginally different, but radically different from what we have known these past 70 years. Unless Americans, says Kagan, can be led back to an understanding of their enlightened self-interest to see again how their fate is entangled with that of the world, then the prospect for a peaceful 21st century in which Americans and American principles can thrive will be bleak, end quote. Kagan draws on Roosevelt to make his case, noting that FDR asked Americans to defend, quote, not their homes alone, but the tenets of faith and humanity on which their churches, their governments, and their very civilization are founded, end quote. Perhaps Americans, writes Kagan, can be inspired in this way again without the threat of a Hitler or an attack on their homeland. But this time they will not have 20 years to decide, he reminds his readers. The world will change much more quickly than they imagine, and there's no democratic superpower waiting in the wings to save the world if this democratic superpower falters, end quote. That's Robert Kagan, co-founder of PNAC, in the New Republic, declaring another PNAC. I hardly think it's a coincidence that a PNAC signatory, Paula Dobriansky, the Undersecretary for State for Democracy for the 8 years of George Bush and currently a senior fellow at Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, picked up a similar theme in the Washington Post. On May 23rd, in an article entitled, quote, U.S. needs a strong moral narrative to combat Putin, she suggests that, quote, by treating Russia's aggression against Ukraine as a discrete problem, the West has overlooked the broader strategic and moral dimensions of Moscow's behavior. End quote. Having twisted the recent history on its head, she concludes that, quote, a new Western strategy encompassing these dimensions and drawing on the Cold War lessons is urgently needed. Only such a strategy, she writes, articulated through a presidential speech and subsequent communications by senior Western officials, can rally needed domestic support, be sustainable, and succeed. During the Cold War, she goes on, the West had a strong moral narrative explaining why Soviet behavior was wrong and what the United States and its allies stood for. Winston Churchill, she said, defined it in his 1946 speech in Fulton, Missouri. The Soviets sought subjugation of other countries. The West aspired to establish freedom and democracy. Although Russia is no longer a Marxist-Leninist state, President Vladimir Putin, she says, is seeking to reverse the consequences of the Soviet Union's dissolution, which he has termed a major geopolitical disaster. Moscow's aggression, she writes, against Ukraine is a component of the strategic vision, not isolated behavior. As if the U.S. orchestrated coup in February had not taken place, but this is the official narrative which the mainstream press has accepted without a challenge. And Iran, let's not forget Iran, which since the invasion of Iraq has been in the crosshairs of the neocons of Israel and the Congress over which, on Middle East issues, Israel's U.S. agents exert total domination. One needs no further proof than the votes of both Senate and House to come to the aid of Israel militarily, should it choose to attack Iran in what it would define as self-defense. Consequently, an article written for the Washington Post under the auspices of the Foreign Policy Initiative by the ubiquitous Dennis Ross, Eric Edelman, and Ray Takeya disingenuously recommends that Obama not only get Congress's approval of any agreement made with Iran, but that he should bring members of the Republican Party into the negotiating process. Ross, who has served under four presidents, is one of the founders of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, an AIPAC spawn that dates back to 1985, who has been described as Israel's lawyer by Aaron David Miller, a fellow White House appointee, also pro-Israel, who worked with him. Adelman is listed by the Post as a distinguished fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments and served as an Undersecretary of Defense during George W. Bush administration. He was also a PNAC signatory, but that's not mentioned. Takei is a senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations and an Iran expert. Arms control, they say, has often been a bone of contention between the White House and Congress, as if these negotiations would require Washington to curtail any aspect of U.S. arms production. Continuing in the same vein, they argue that, quote, presidents and their diplomats prefer to reach agreements in secret and then shield the accord from congressional scrutiny, much less content. It's all too tempting for the Obama administration, they say, to follow this script as it negotiates with Iran, but that would be a mistake, end quote. And then they go on, notwithstanding partisan difficulties, seeking congressional endorsement is essential lest any agreement rest on a shaky foundation and be difficult to implement. Clearly, given the control over Congress by the Israel lobby, as demonstrated by the numerous resolutions and pieces of legislation it has passed targeting Iran, there'd be no chance that Congress would approve any agreement that would allow Tehran to continue with any form of nuclear enrichment. Moreover, whatever agreement that Iran would reach with the P5 plus one countries, it would not appear to fall under the category of a treaty as defined by the Constitution, since the U.S. would not be required to give up anything in exchange for Iran's cutting back on its legitimate nuclear energy program. Yet they argue, quote, arms control has often been a bone of contention between the White House and Congress, and presidents and the diplomats prefer to reach agreements in secret and then shield the accord from congressional scrutiny, much less consent, ignoring the fact that every formal treaty requiring mutual concession, which this would not be, requires congressional consent. Hence their suggestion that according to this, to them, since at this point the Obama administration's Iran policy rests on no such national consensus, the president could do much to alter this reality by offering detailed briefings on the Hill and even including Republican staffers and U.S. delegations to the P5 plus one talk, end quote. That's what's meant by chutzpah. Though these men, not lightweights in the political arena, are determined that the negotiations with Iran will fail and that the U.S. will be obliged to attack Iran's nuclear facilities. That's Israel's agenda, not America's. They are entitled to their opinions, of course, but where's our mainstream media challenging them? Where are those who will challenge the neocons calling for a new Cold War? The answer, they're non-existent.